From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dubai is home to the world's biggest shopping mall, the tallest man-made structure, the Burj Khalifa. People from around the globe who come to work in one of the most expensive cities in the world see luxury, sparkling skyscrapers, a model maybe of globalized capitalism and personal detachment and unmoored Disneyland, a symbol maybe of where we all could be headed. This hour, On Point novelist Joseph O'Neill takes on Dubai and us. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this the future? Pixels and polish and empty glitter. Do we glimpse ourselves in the desert mirror of Dubai? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. All kinds of excitement in the media for years now about this city between the desert and the Gulf. Here's Piers Morgan describing Dubai's transformation to magnificence in the 2011 documentary, The Luxury Life of Dubai and a Luxury Tour of Dubai.
If you came to Dubai a few years ago, you'd have got this, sand and loads of it. Then an amazing thing happened.
Fantasy became reality. In the space of just 20 years, Dubai turned from desert into a jaw-dropping oasis of stone, marble, concrete, glass, and raw excitement.
And how does Dubai present itself? Here's a promotional video from Emirates Experience, labeling Dubai as the shopping capital of the Middle East, maybe the world.
Home to more than 20 stunning malls with everything from international high street labels to the world's most luxurious brands. Fashionistas look no further. The wall-to-wall designer names rival those of Paris, New York, and London.
Great, or maybe not so great. Joining me now from New York is Joseph O'Neill, author of the highly praised novel Netherland. It won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. New York Times called Netherland the wittiest, angriest, most exacting, and most desolate work of fiction we've had yet about life in New York and London after the World Trade Center fell. He takes on Dubai, modern morality, our sense of morality in his new book, The Dog. Joseph O'Neill, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you again.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here again.
That took a while. You're not a fast writer, you say.
No one's ever accused me of that. I also, it's not just a question of speed, but, you know, a personal slowness. I also wonder sometimes, you know, just how many novels we need to have out there and how many, you know, I actually want to write. So I'm quite happy with my output rate. Every five or six years is good.
Great. And we're glad you're back. The Abracadabrapolis. Why? Why this name for Dubai? Maybe we already hear it there in the kind of Piers Morgan treatment and their own treatment of themselves, but it's the label that gets popped on it here in The Dog, your novel. Why?
Well, because it seems like magic almost. I mean, the initial advertising burst for Dubai, which has slightly changed as the brand of Dubai itself has changed, mm-hmm. but the initial image of Dubai promoted by the Emirates was that mentioned by Piers Morgan in that clip, which is just bare sand, and then you flash forward in time photographically, and then you see these extraordinary buildings. In a very short space of time. So it has the kind of hey presto kind of feel about it. And there's something slightly kind of unreal about this sort of transformation at this sort of speed, as if we're in the realm of the illusion, possibly. And so it does have an abracadabra feel about it, I think.
It's funny that just in that clip from Piers, he's already kind of got to the core of your book. He says, you know, the place where fantasy became reality. Reality becomes fantasy is another way of looking at that. This is not a plot-driven book, really, but I wish you'd share just a little bit of the story that the ruminations hang on in The Dog. What's going on here, Joseph?
Well, our hero, our viewpoint, is this American attorney who flees New York City and a bad breakup and gets a job in Dubai working for a family, the Batros family, who are multi-millionaires or ultra-high net worth, as he calls them. They're possibly billionaires. He's not quite sure how rich they are. And his job is that of family officer, which is to look after their holdings, etc. And he's offered the job by an old college friend who he runs into. So he goes to Dubai with the ambition, not only great professional ambition, but just the sort of rather defeated personal ambition to be neither in the right nor in the wrong, as he puts it. He's sort of so traumatized by the by what's happened to him in New York, that he just sort of jumped ship and he could equally have gone anywhere else. This was just the place to which he happened to escape.
It sets off on what becomes a kind of metaphorical, metaphysical adventure for all of us, not always so adventurous in traditional terms, but he starts out dazzled like almost everybody else when he begins to investigate Dubai. Joseph O'Neill, could you read just a little bit from early on in The Dog where he's sort of dipping in to, I think this is before it even arrives, just we can all dip into anything these days via the internet, and he's starting to take on Dubai.
Yeah, he goes online when it finally dawns on him that he might be headed there. He goes online and Googles it essentially, and this is what happens when the results pop up. I couldn't believe my eyes, in part because I was not actually meant to believe my eyes, or was meant to believe them in a special way, because many of the image results were not photographs of a real Dubai, but rather renderings of a Dubai that was under construction or as yet conceptual. In any case, I was left with the impression of a fantastic, actual and or soon-to-be city, an abracadabrapolis in which buildings flopped against each other and skyscrapers looked wobbly or were rumpled, or might be twice as tall and slender as the Empire State Building, a city whose coastline featured bizarre man-made peninsulas, as well as those already famous artificial islets known as the World, so named because they were grouped to suggest to a bird's eye a physical map of the world, a city where huge stilts rose out of the earth and disappeared like Jack's beanstalk 300 metres up into a synthetic cloud. Apparently the cloud contained, or would in due course contain, a platform with a park and other amenities.
Dubai, constructed to create just that sort of frisson of wonderment you quote in the narrative here. Your unnamed narrator overhears an Albanian manager of his local hardware store in New York talking about Dubai, of all things. He says, they got a hotel at the bottom of the sea. They got millionaires, billionaires. Beckham lives there. Brad Pitt lives there. Every day you got Lamborghinis crashing into other Lamborghinis. Every day you got sunshine. The gas is basically free. They got no taxes. It's heaven on earth. You lead us to see that it was built to be seen that way. It is, in a way, intended to be a mirror or a come on.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Dubai is that it has no oil. It's an emirate, which unlike, say, Abu Dhabi, which has lots of oil, Dubai has very little oil. And so they decided that they would safeguard their future by becoming a tourist destination. And I suppose the next question was, well, what will draw rich, i.e. Western tourists here? Mainly Western, a lot of Arab tourists go there also, it must be said. Mm. And the answer was shopping, I suppose. Shopping and this kind of idea of prestige. And, for those of us who sort of are inclined to feel a bit snobbish about the materialism of Dubai and the shallowness of it, I suppose we have to reflect on the fact that the whole place is based on this idea of what we actually want from them. So I suppose it is a kind of mirror.
You take it right on from there, a mirror, but also a place of detachment. Was it J.P. O'Malley in the Daily Beast? He writes about the dog. He says, the dog surpasses simply documenting the alienation endemic in the 21st century global village. Instead, it walks a fine line between the imaginary fantasies of our mind and the so-called reality that is now the greatest fiction of all. Dubai as a fiction created to please, to draw us and others, and reality kind of miraging away, Joseph.
Well, I mean, the question of the mirage is obviously a very old one in these areas, and I do feel that in the passage I just read, our narrator has difficulties in distinguishing between images of actual Dubai and images of a projected Dubai, which are offered by way of renderings, mm-hmm. and. I do think we zoom forward technologically and I suppose capitalistically into the future, and we become more and more struck by how pervasive our fantastical life is in terms of reality. In other words, you know, there are these enormous kind of profits to be made from catering to our fantasies and from eroding our sense of reality. And those, you know, and Dubai is a very kind of obvious center of that effort to kind of cash in on our so-called dreams and or our, what people perceive to be our dreams of prestige, of luxury, etc. And constantly sort of chipping away at what used to be these kind of non-electronic ideas of reality, which, you know, of community, ideas of identity and community, which have anchored us for, you know, for centuries, if not thousands of years.
It's a little less thrilling. His actual experience being there as an expat American in Dubai. Yes, you can look out and see that skyline of incredible skyscrapers, but so much of his time is just in his room, on his computer, like everybody else, it seems, in the world, you know, looking at pixels and where's the human connection?
Well, I mean, he's not really there in order to shop. So it's not really, Dubai isn't really particularly designed for him. But that's the question. I mean, how is it possible to build a life that's based around our material wishes?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Fireworks sound off behind me there, flooding the Dubai sky at the opening of the 163-floor Burj Khalifa tower, the tallest man-made structure in the world. That was January 2010. We're talking with this hour with novelist Joseph O'Neill about his latest, set in sparkling, ultra-sleek and dark Dubai. An American lost in the moral maze of life now, a kind of black comedy set in Dubai. It's called The Dog. It's all about transience and shopping and a kind of fantasy life. Here's a little sound of travelers passing through the Dubai airport. They stop to browse at the gold counter.
And those little ones are about 3 ounces. Pretty nice.
And expats living in Dubai, here's one, Rupert Bumfrey, what a name, an expat living in Dubai saying he knows he may not stay in Dubai forever.
We know the realities of living in Dubai. We're guests here. Companies can close down. Economic cycles mean we're sacked, have to go back home.
Economic cycles out of the dream. Joseph, lots of calls for you. Let me turn to a few. Josh in Oklahoma, Yukon, Oklahoma. You're on with Josh, with Joseph O'Neill, Josh.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
About 20 years ago, from 1997 to 2000, I was in the Navy, and we actually went on excursions in Dubai and also at the Goat Souk. And over time, I kind of just, you know, ignored it all, you know, just... We've seen it when they were starting to work on the Palm Island, and it was so massive, and we were just, everybody was in doubt. They were like, it's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. And about, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, seeing a magazine with Dubai and that same Palm Island that they were working on, and I am just floored that they actually did that. And then just to see on the, like, Travel Channel and Discovery Channel, and it still amazes how much of a feat that they had to do from 20 years ago to now.
It is kind of miraculous, and nobody questions that. What drives the vision of the miracle is sort of the subject of Joseph O'Neill's book. Josh, I appreciate your call. I mean, Joseph, it's not as though you yourself spent tons and tons of time in Dubai. It kind of lives in all our minds. I think you spent a couple of weeks there over time.
Yeah, I went there just for two visits for about a week each for the specific purpose of researching this book. Our character. I went online before then, and mm-hmm. I just thought, I can't believe this place. And I was a bit like Josh from Oklahoma. I was just taken aback by this fantastic effort of construction. And just and of course the next question is, as you say, what next? What's this construction actually about?
So connect the artistic dots for us here a little bit, or the metaphorical dots. I mean, I've read you saying that after Netherland came out, and where you've got New Yorkers and cricket in New York and a wonderful kind of meditation on post 9/11 New York, you were reading big philosophers, Kierkegaard and Foucault, Derrida, Heidegger, Agamben. What was it about that reading that led you to sort of want to hang your story on Dubai?
Well, I mean, first of all, that's a pretty terrifying list of names you've just mentioned.
Yes, it is.
I don't claim to understand much of it. And in fact, it's the fact that what I love about philosophy and the writing of philosophy is that I just don't really understand it very well. So it reads like a kind of poetry to me. And so that's what drew me, out of my enclave of novel reading into the world of philosophy, of philosophical prose. I just love the way it looked on the page, and I love the intensity and seriousness of these philosophers, who are kind of comic characters if you think about it. They actually wake up in the morning and really think hard about the world, and then write these kind of wonderfully impassioned and dense volumes of reflection. And we sort of count on them to do it without, ever kind of really paying too much attention, we being, your average person. So they struck me as rather poignant figures, these theorists and people who are thinking so hard about things. And I thought, well, that's the kind of person, these people do exist, and that's the kind of temperament and the kind of theoretical, thoughtful, slightly anxious person I'd love to have at the center of my book. And then separately from that, there's this fascination with Dubai, and then you bring them together. So you have a voice, and then you have a sort of interest in Dubai. Of course, as it happens, some of those thinkers that you've mentioned, what they've been writing about is very, very interesting to me in the context of Dubai. In all sorts of ways.
Let's hear a little bit of that through the ruminations of your character. Unnamed character, kind of a sad sack in a way. The Batros family hires him after, it turns out he went to college with one of them, had no idea that they were zillionaires, runs into him in New York, and the next thing you know, he's out, and there's some pretty shady business going on. But here he is looking out from his high perch in Dubai and meditating a little bit on beauty and morality. He's conflicted looking at all this, sitting in his massage chair overlooking in Dubai. Could you read a bit for us there, Joseph?
Yeah, it's important to note that this is his sort of favorite thing, as he sort of just lives by himself, is to sit in his massage chair and look out the window at construction sites.
But there are plenty in Dubai.
Everywhere you look in Dubai, there's a construction site. So he's in that sense, he's very well situated. And incidentally, his building is called The Situation,
yes,
which is, you know, in Dubai, all the buildings have these fantastic names.
The metaphysical.
And that habit actually, yeah, the situation, the address, the prestige, the place to be. Mm-hmm. You know, they have these very literally prestigious names. But then he goes on after he looks, and then he can't help himself. He starts thinking. And then he thinks, I still think about the afternoon when at a spot not far from the wilds allocated to Dubai Land, I should just interrupt, was Dubai's response to Disneyland, and they just decided to call it Dubai Land. At a spot not far from the wilds allocated to Dubai Land, I stopped the autobiography, that's his car, and got out into the heat and wind to take in, without the mediation of the windshield, Dubai's little row of towers, visible as if adrift, miles away across the level desert. The city could not have more resembled a Fata Morgana, and that was the whole idea. If I might psychologize, the reliance on the mirage or wonder equation is not just a marketing ploy. It is a secret revenge on the mirage itself, and only one facet of the Dubaian counterattack on the natural. The crimes of nature against man in this part of the world are not restricted to the mockery of the visual sense. The slightest effort of reflection must yield an awareness of the suffering and lowliness that these barren and desolate sands have without cease inflicted on their human inhabitants. and it cannot be a surprise, now that the shoe is on the other foot, that the transformation of this place is characterized by attempts at domination directed not only against the heat and dust, but, as is evident from the native somewhat irrational hostility to solar energy and their unusual dedication to the artificial settlement of marine areas, against the very sun and the very sea.
Joseph O'Neill, reading from The Dog, take it as a metaphor for much more than Dubai. Judy in Richmond, Virginia. Judy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. In hearing all of this, it sounds like that maybe some of the perception of Dubai, maybe we would say they were the Kardashians or even the Andy Warhol of the Middle East. Would this apply? I mean, all the fascination about all the glitz and bling.
Yeah, Joseph?
Oh, I think that's, that's perceptive. I mean, the building, his name, The Situation, there's a character called The Situation.
American reality television, of
course. In American reality TV shows. And, there's definitely some sort of connection there. And it's by no means, the kind of bling idea, as the callers point out from Virginia, and by no means restricted to Dubai. I mean, there was no bling in Dubai 20 years ago. It was just, Dubai, such as it was. And so, there was little bling, I should say, and it's not exaggerated.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all interconnected. And I suppose the question is, the question which arises, or many questions arise, but one which sort of interests me and which I think this book tries to investigate, is to what extent our sense of belonging somewhere, our sense of identity, is being eroded from our old structures. Like, in the old days, one would say, well, I'm a caller from Virginia, or I belong to this country and this community. But nowadays, it seems to me, there seems to be such and you see this in Dubai, there's such a strong connection to work and money, etc., that seems to be increasingly acting, as it were, in opposition to our older senses of identity.
And that may be, well, it's not all, but it's almost overpowering. We heard you read that the city could not have more resembled a Fata Morgana, and that was the whole idea, of course, Fata Morgana, that Fata was sort of vulgar Latin word for fairy, and Morgana, like Arthur's, the sorceress, Morgan Le Fay, this mirage. It intended to be a kind of mirage in its feel, Joseph.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's almost as if we're reassured by the lack of reality of our lives, and that the less real it is, the better. That's a fairly desperate sort of and cynical state of affairs. But increasingly, it seems to be. It seems to be the case. I mean, we sort of wake up and at all costs seek diversion and, stimulation.
Pooja is calling from Glasgow, Kentucky. Not Scotland today, but Pooja, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. O'Neill. I really appreciate the theme of your book. Basically, I feel like in America, we're tiptoeing that line of detachment by living our lives kind of promoting our own perceived image on social media, living our lives through filters. Just as you were saying how Dubai, when you looked up pictures, it's all renderings of actualizations of what they want it to look like. And I feel like Dubai is really the full circle of that detachment. And we are all kind of slowly heading in that direction, which is a little, unsettling.
Yeah, to say the least.
I mean, that's a brilliant point. I mean, when people in Dubai talk about brand Dubai, they don't even talk about it in the kind of conventional terms of a kind of nation state. And why would they? 10% of Dubaians are citizens, and 90% or so are essentially guests or visitors who are only allowed there as tourists or as workers, and then have to leave. So, and I love this idea that this is now apparent at the individual level, where we, and on social media, we offer renderings of ourselves rather than actual human flesh. We have an electronic and virtual presence that sort of rules us, and so that each of us, the human individual is now turning into this brand. How often LinkedIn to play various places? How often have we been struck by the sort of the gap between the kind of the online persona or kind of presence, you know, with the curated blogs that people show about themselves. Again, I'm not being critical. I see the impulse. Mm-hmm. But as the caller notes, it's extremely, it's striking and it's sort of unsettling.
Epitomized, made huge in Dubai. Joseph O'Neill is with us. His new novel is The Dog. Bob in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Pooja, thanks for calling. Bob, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I make this call in deference to my son, Max, who's a weightlifter. And he always repeatedly points out to me how not in our bodies we all are. My son is...
How not in our bodies we are, okay.
Yeah, he lifts weights, and he's very not into school, not into shopping. He just sees it all as being all in your head and not enough in the body. And when I heard the author talk about, you know, not having a place, seems to my son, at least, and I guess to me as well, that in order to be in a place, you have to be in your body to experience that place. And the more and more we're just in our thoughts and in our minds that we don't take possession of our bodies, and so we can't really be anywhere.
Bob, I think you've picked right up on the thread of Joseph O'Neill here, and I appreciate your call. A weightlifter son who his lament is we are not in our bodies. I mean, Joseph, in The Dog, even. I mean, talk about being in your body, even when in his sexual life, lots of Russian, young Russian women in Dubai, he goes to them, prostitutes, but it's got this fascinating thing where it's, even that is so unreal. Maybe the ultimate should be the in your body thing, that he goes afterward to look online at images of where they may have come from in Russia, these sort of tumble down housing developments in Russia.
Yes.
To try and make some connection, but it's not in the flesh, it's later online.
Yes, I mean, it's the body is just this, the column points, you know, it's this fascinating dichotomy between the physical life and the mental life. And the physical life is actually becoming highly problematic and sort of, for example, Dubai is this incredible place, but it's built by physical labor. And so our hero looks out the window and sees the bodies of the people building these buildings, moving around almost entomologically. He thinks of them as a kind of ant colony almost. And you see how these individuals, I mean, this is the other side, their sort of physical dimension has almost been captured, and that their whole existence as human beings is subject to this kind of extreme physicality of working as a construction worker in the desert sand, something my father did, incidentally, but obviously not in daylight. They used to work. My father worked in Abu Dhabi, building, I think, a refinery back in the early 70s.
Wow.
And I remember him telling me that they would work at night, essentially. It was impossible to work at day. But in Dubai, as we are finding out in Qatar as well, in preparation for the Soccer World Cup, the workers who were all from East India, from South Asia, I should say, are very often made to work in their desert heat. So there's that sort of drama of physical imprisonment. And then, as you say, there's the problem of human encounters, which is, in the end, inescapably physical.
The images, the depictions, all sparkling and wonderful. Joseph O'Neill, in the front of his new novel, The Dog, quotes Shakespeare from Macbeth. "Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand." Joseph O'Neill, stand by in New York, please. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with novelist Joseph O'Neill about his latest, set in sparkling, ultra-sleek, and dark Dubai. An American expatriate lost in the kind of moral maze of life now, a black comedy in its way. It's called The Dog. Joseph O'Neill joins us from New York. J.P. O'Malley writes, again in the Daily Beast, says, "Dubai, the novel's milieu, almost becomes a microcosm for the world at large. If nation-states once gave each individual a vision, common ideology, or value system in which they could find meaning, modern capitalism, O'Neill subtly seems to be suggesting here, has made this idea of a shared purpose obsolete. What matters now is only one thing, freedom that comes from the power of earning endless bundles of cash. The unnamed protagonist here working for the Batros family, Lebanese, with the kind of headquarters and homes in Dubai, a home with its own ATM in the house, a family so rich they have their own Hong Kong Shanghai Bank ATM in the house. David in Williamsville, New York, you're on the air with Joseph O'Neill. Thanks for calling, David.
Thank you. I confess to having a literally limited point of view on this because I am totally blind, and I can only think that the experience of Dubai seems to be predominantly a visual one. And to me, that would just be a very empty existence and experience without the smells, without sounds, without tastes, without people's voices. To me, it sounds very cold, despite the heat.
David, I'm so grateful for your call. Joseph, how about it? Our totally blind caller finds nothing to grab onto.
Well, that's because, you know, there's a limited amount of money people can make out of blind people, as he well knows and ruefully probably reflects on from time to time.
But where's the hurly-burly, the organic sort of market, grand cities have plenty of smell and sound.
There's nothing eye-catching, literally, about things that smell good. They do have, in Dubai, they do have sort of... you know, these perfumes and vapors which they pump into the lobbies of various buildings and sort of make you feel kind of good. But no, it's got to be said. It's a massive visual marketing exercise. And you know, the sort of the limitations of Dubai and the rigidities of the way it's structured are not simply confined to the question of the senses. Mm-hmm. You know, the weird thing about Dubai is you can't really be self-employed there. The sort of intermediate people who we kind of rely on to make life interesting, the people who are not necessarily working for a corporation, who are not necessarily working for the government, etc., self-employed people, artists, musicians, etc., if you're a foreigner, it's almost impossible to kind of be as kind of freelancer there. So there's all sorts of categories, including the, as the caller calls, the other categories, the non-visual categories. There are all kinds of categories of experience that have little place in Dubai. I imagine as the society develops a little, that'll change. But at the moment, the format, and it is a very formatted place, is a pretty rigid one.
Yeah, I should say, that impression.
But I would like to emphasize that, you know, this book isn't about looking around the world and alighting on Dubai and then mocking it for, you know, spending 5 years mocking it. Mm-hmm. It's precisely the format of Dubai. It seems, I suppose this is the question the book asks, is it a distillation of our own society? I mean, we keep referring to the future. Is this where we're headed? And I suppose the other question is this where we already are? Dubai physically resembles, since we're about talking about that, lots of parts of the United States, which are also built on desert and which also revolve around huge air-conditioned kind of interiors, essentially.
Yeah, here one of our listeners, Costco, says, Abracadabrapolis sounds fitting for many a Disneyfied U.S. city, many a post-secondary campus, if not an apt metaphor for the U.S. at large. No, not just wagging fingers here. In fact, it kind of built in response to our dreams, Joseph O'Neill says. Norman in Cleveland, Ohio. Norman, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Mr. O'Neill, you got a great speaking voice. I hope you're going to have this book on tape.
Good, yeah, but yes. Not by me, believe me. A better speaking voice has done it on tape.
You got a great voice. My question is, I mean, you're talking about, you know, this big shopping mecca and a playground for the rich. But, see, you know, people have to keep this thing going. I'm wondering how the workers at the restaurants live. The cab drivers, the bellhops. How do they live there?
Well, that's a great question. These are the people who do the kind of the kind of menial jobs, as they would be called over there, are also foreigners, and they come on limited contracts, and they're not very happy on the whole. You know, so that's it's sustainable. But this idea that it's only millionaires who go to Dubai is, of course, just a branding myth. The actual people who consume the Dubai legend and the Dubai myth are kind of much more aspirational people. They're Europeans, many. I mean, in the United States, we don't. It's so far away. It's quite a why would we go all the way there when we've got places not dissimilar right here on our doorstep? Or, it's aspirational European types. And there's a scene in the book where the hero goes to have a drink in a bar, in a hotel bar. And he sort of, and everyone sort of there, you know, looks at him as, looks at whoever's coming into the bar as if Hulk Hogan might appear or Henry Kissinger mm. might appear. And of course, they never do. So I think it's, you know, it's, but of course, the problem of the labor force there is a very complicated problem and has all kinds of dark aspects to it.
We've got a caller who might speak to that. Norman, thanks for your call from Ohio. Bonnie in Harwich, Massachusetts. Bonnie, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I go to Dubai frequently, and I've seen quite a bit of it. I want to tell you that most of the workers in the hotels, in the malls, are not from Dubai.
Yes, we got it.
Locals do not stoop to that level. All of the water is desalinated, every single bit, and they're very, very. They don't think much of using water or wasting it. The malls, you'll see, many of them are large large areas that are nobody goes into, some of the designer stores, and I am told that they are government subsidized, that they want to have a presence, they want big names to have a presence there, and so that's why it appears so luxurious, but very few people go in to even do that. I was on a tour, and there's very little to see. You run out after half a day. You go out into the desert, and you can ride in the dune buggies. But there's very, very little to see, except you do go by some of the workers' housing, and it's really impoverished. It's like cement barracks,
These are sort of Pakistanis or others living in the desert.
Yes, and Filipinos. That's right.
Mm, yes.
And for things like some of their big events like golfing and horse racing, the government pays for hotels. They pay for your transportation over there. It's all government underneath a pretty shallow civilization in my part.
But Bonnie, I appreciate your call. Joseph O'Neill, your hero, as you put it, meditates or begins to on these moral questions. Here he is sitting in kind of the lap of luxury, but he's not unaware of what it takes to keep this Disney-fied oasis going. Talk to us about how you present his moral grappling.
Well, he's actually very sensitive to it. I think anyone who goes to Dubai, certainly, like our caller is from the West, is struck by all kinds of things, and which alarming things as well as kind of luxurious things. And I suppose if you live there, like as an expat, you have to sort of reckon with the fact that your existence there comes at an enormous cost to the planet, an enormous cost to you know, the people who built it and continue to build it and who service the place. And there are various scenes where our character is kind of. It goes through all kinds of mental calculations and sort of justifications to deal with these issues. But the thing about Dubai, of course, is that it's transparent. It's there. It's all taking place mm-hmm. now. So the inequality that underwrites and exploitation that underwrites this amazing city is visible right now and transparent. Of course, if we were to think for a second, as our narrator does this, about the inequality that underwrites our great cities here in the West, and I'm not just talking about the United States, I'm talking mm-hmm. about everywhere, and you know, in terms of the colonial exploitation that underwrote it, and the in this country, the sort of economic injustice, not to mention the sort of, you know, the sort of Native American sort of
sure.
etc. So we're in a luxurious position of having of having our cake and eating it here in the West in many ways. Whereas, of course, you know, our own moral foundations are pretty precarious as well, as I'm sure, you know, we know if we think about it for a second.
Not to mention our own right now interaction with reality sometimes. Mary in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Mary, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I don't know much about Dubai, but I think it sounds like a great book. But I've been a nurse for almost 40 years, and I feel like in my time, people, in my generation, people have become less and less in reality, and they don't want to be in reality. They would rather, you know, I know many people that would rather take an antidepressant than to change what's going on bad in their life. Prescription drugs, antidepressants, street drugs, whatever. People, I don't feel, are in reality. I don't, and the way our government works, everything, it's like everything around us is getting worse and worse, and people would rather go to a place like this and forget about the real problems of life.
Mary, I so appreciate your call. I think you're tapping right into a big piece of what Joseph O'Neill's pointing at, the nurse who hands out the pills. Joseph, I wonder if you'd read, because this kind of gets to your protagonist's sense of that. Very late in the book, he's feels like he's just sinking, and he's thinking about when he started to go down, and his human connections and lack thereof, and where he's headed. It's just a short bit, but I wonder if you'd read.
Yeah, he's sort of, this is towards the end of the book. I mean, not right at the end, but it's sort of heading towards it. And obviously, like a character in most novels, things start to hot up for him towards the end. And he's sort of desperately trying to figure out how on earth he's got to where he is. And he starts theorizing, because that's his disposition. Mm-hmm. And he says, "It's in the spirit of the doomed last-ditch sortie that I embraced the idea of the submarine to attempt to account for the deep element of illusion into which it feels like I have been hurled, as if, and here one definitively leaves behind the stockade of the literal, as if at some point in one's past one was thrown unconscious overboard, and one has only now gained an awareness of one's situation, which is that of the human person going downward in water, and one is in a fix, to put it mildly, and heedless fish people swim by, and a terrible bathyal reality prevails, and one can only go down and cannot breathe, and one's humanness has no medium."
And one's humanness has no medium. Joseph O'Neill reading from The Dog. Chad in Clarksville, Tennessee. You're on with Joseph O'Neill, Chad.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well.
Well, my question is, I know that it seems like in society today that we do want to catch a glimpse of something that is beyond our grasp a little bit, and we strive for that, and we get to those parts in our life where we can find that, and then we realize we've gotten so much that we don't want it anymore. But by that time, it's too late, and now we have to catch it. We have to keep up that standard that we've made. Do you feel like some of those things have happened in this Dubai atmosphere?
In Dubai or all around us, Joseph?
Well, I mean, I think this goes back we have to sort of, what I think about and the book thinks about, I suppose, is we as the caller acknowledges, we seem to be in this constant cycle of reaching out. I mean, it may well be that the human being has always and has evolved to sort of be constantly seeking improvement and is constantly dissatisfied, because the more dissatisfied you are, the more likely you are to prosper and to reproduce and the rest of it. So it may not be a modern thing. It may be an ancient problem. But the problem has certainly been taken a new character in recent years with the emergence of the kind of new efficiency of, you know, capitalism. And, you know, it's extremely difficult. And I say this as someone with young children who are targeted from the first, you know, moment of consciousness by the profit-making kind of energies out there and or corporations out there. It's extremely difficult to kind of escape this cycle of wanting more and seeking out more because it's so profitable to keep us in this state.
Joseph, I wonder about your own life and how it comes into play here. I mean, your tag is Irish novelist, but that doesn't really begin to fully tell the story. It's so interesting. I mean, Wikipedia describes you as half Irish and half Assyrian. I'm not sure exactly what that means. You grew up living in Mozambique and
Assyrian,
Turkey, Iran.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up, I was born in Ireland. My mother's Turkish, mm-hmm. and my father's Irish. And but my father, as I mentioned earlier, was in the construction business, oil construction, refinery construction business for decades. And of course, that took him all around the world in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s when he started working in pharmaceutical field. Mm-hmm. And so with the family would sort of tag along for most part until eventually I grew up in Holland, where they decided that they would stay put while my father continued to travel. But I suppose the interesting fact, which I'm sort of coming to terms with now, almost after the event, is that my mother, although Turkish, belongs to an Arab minority in Turkey, a Christian Arab minority. And I grew up listening to Arabic being spoken by my grandmother and her sisters and friends. And so I always associate the sound of Arabic with the sound of sort of love, really, because these women always were very loving. And so in writing this book, I'm kind of going to the kind of this mysterious kind of Arab part of my identity.
And once again, to sort of the heart of what's going on. You were right there after 9/11 with Netherland. Here you are, the financial crash happening right in the middle of this book. I don't know if you've begun your next one, but what next? Are you going to be somehow commenting on ISIS or Ebola or China's Alibaba? Speaking of abracadabra.
I wanted to write about Dubai. I had no idea the financial crisis was going to happen. It just did. Same thing with Netherland when I wrote that. I had no idea. I was writing about New York cricket, and then 9/11 happened. So I suppose I have no idea what's going to happen. But, you know, why not be receptive to what's going on? Why not try and do something about contemporary reality?
Yes, please. Do it. And do it again. Joseph O'Neill's new novel is The Dog. It's always such a pleasure talking with you. Really grateful to you for spending an hour with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Tom.
Pleasure to have you. Joseph O'Neill, author of, most lately, The Dog. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Amanda Gomez and Madeline Moore. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.